The first item we're going to have today is a hearing, public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 2977, establishes Law Enforcement Medal of Honor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2977 would establish the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor. It specifically describes the style and make of the medal. It establishes the Governor's Commission on the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor and establishes who should serve, it's a, by Governor's appointment, but lists who should be appointed by the Governor from various backgrounds. The Commission would set up rules to determine or set up criteria to determine who would be nominated and meet at least once every 6 months to consider the candidates for a nomination and nominate candidates. DPSST will provide the staff for the commission. There also is a fund that it establishes the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor Fund and allows the commission to seek and accept contributions for that separate fund that would pay for the medal itself.
Okay, thank you. I have one somewhere here from our previous.
Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm really just window dressing this morning. I did want to point out that you're going to receive an item here that basically goes through the key provisions of this, as counsel just already provided you. So I'm not going to go over the details of how this is structured, except to say that there is no general fund appropriation for this. This is a fund that's created, and we believe in the law enforcement community that we will be able to raise necessary funds to provide for these awards and the costs that are incurred as a part of that. The commission members themselves would not receive per diem or compensation or reimbursement. This would be something they would volunteer their time to do, and we expect that this commission would meet at least twice per year to consider those who have distinguished themselves through honorable and meritorious service. And many of those, as we'll talk about in a minute, occur posthumously after death, because, as you know, when officers are involved in meritorious service, often that involves the most tragic of events. And so this morning what I'd like to do is just introduce the folks that are with me this morning. I have Chief Lane Roberts. He's from the Redmond Police Department. And Chief Ken Johnson, Chief Johnson's from the Fairview Department. Both of these folks have had specific experience with the Washington Medal of Honor. There's only a few of these in the United States, a few states that do this, and they'd like to talk a little bit about their experience on that. And then I have Dan Swift as well from the Oregon State Police Officers Association. And so with that, the window dressing is going to go sit down, and I'm going to let these folks talk to you for a minute, and I appreciate the committee's consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lane Roberts. I'm currently the Chief of Police in Redmond. Prior to that, I served approximately 28 years in the state of Washington, about 20 years of that in an executive capacity. I'm confident that the people who are here with me could address this very adequately, but I felt it important that I come over to at least take a moment to express what I believe is maybe the only concern regarding this. I have heard it said that this is somehow a matter of law enforcement self-aggrandizing, honoring itself. I was present when the Washington Medal was established, and that is not an unusual comment, but it's a tragic one. The fact is that the medal is not about us honoring anybody. To the contrary, it's a recognition of the honor that someone has brought upon themselves by their service and the nature of the conduct. That conduct and the circumstances that lead to it are so unique that I think that conscience begs that we recognize the service. I would strongly urge this body to adopt this medal. This is not about us honoring ourselves. It's about honoring individuals who honor us with their conduct. And I strongly urge you to support the bill.
Thank you, Chief.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Johnson. I'm the Chief of the Fairview Police Department. I'm also currently serving as a member of the Washington Law Enforcement Medal of Honor Committee. for the governor. Law enforcement officers in Oregon perform an outstanding service to communities of all sizes. Despite encountering dangerous and difficult human circumstances, law enforcement officers perform their duty with honor, integrity, bravery, and patience. Sadly, though, some officers make the ultimate sacrifice, leaving behind grieving loved ones, searching for meaning and closure. When Washington was considering the nation's first law enforcement Medal of Honor, Lieutenant Governor Brad Owen made the following statement about why it is so important for the state to recognize fallen officers. And I quote, "When a police officer is wounded or killed in the line of duty, it is a true tragedy for our entire society. Not only have we experienced a horrible loss to our enforcement community, we have experienced a devastating loss to humanity. It is appropriate and necessary that we honor and recognize the phenomenal sacrifices these brave men and women have made protecting and serving all of us. I have personally spoken to members of families after the governor has placed the medal around their neck. They tell us that the ceremony and the medal have given meaning to their loved one's death and the sacrifice that they have made. It has helped with the healing process and giving them some closure. I will never forget our first award ceremony. The MC read off a brief description of a police officer that was killed responding to a armed robbery. He was ambushed and killed. He called forward the family, shook the wife's hand, and then bent over and placed the medal around a four-year-old son's neck. I'll never forget that little boy when he turned with tears in his eyes, but yet the biggest smile I've ever seen, a prideful smile, and he said, 'This is for my dad.' It is fitting that the governor, on behalf of the citizens, recognize officers who have distinguished themselves by performing their duties with exceptional and honorable meritorious conduct. I urge your support of this bill. It's not just for the law enforcement community. It truly has great meaning to those that are left behind, our loved ones that sacrifice every day for the service that their loved ones give to the community. Thank you very much."
Thank you, Chief.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Obviously, I don't have to explain to this committee, with three retired police officers sitting on it, what our families sacrifice and what the officers themselves sacrifice or what the job entails. I'm more here to, sometimes, especially going through the legislative process, there's some appearance often of management versus labor, and this is not one of those issues. This is one that's supported by the law enforcement community throughout the state of Oregon, regardless of rank, assignment, or feelings about the matter. This is supported by all of us, and this is the type of thing. There isn't anything more that can actually be done for the officer, but coming from California, where we lose about 25 officers killed in the line of duty a year for various reasons, it is about the families and their survivors. And on behalf of all of us in the community, in the law enforcement community in the state of Oregon, I strongly urge you to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Panel, any questions at all? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and move to a work session on House Bill 2977.
Mr. Chair, I move we move House Bill 2977 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Yeah, I'll carry that. Okay. Open a public hearing on 2568. And Judge Koch. You want to go soon?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2568 is here at the request of Doug Bray, the Multnomah County Court Coordinator. What this would do, for those of you who don't know, in Multnomah County there is the downtown courthouse. There is also a satellite courthouse in Gresham. but I use the term courthouse loosely because having served there myself as a Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney, I can tell you my office was right next to the tap dance studio where the six-year-olds would come to do their tap dance lessons every day. As a result, House Bill 2568 is here in part because there is not a custody facility there, and this would require the Circuit Court in Gresham to transfer proceedings to the downtown court facility if the individual is in custody of the county sheriff or Department of Corrections. It also would require the accused to request transfer from the court in Gresham to the downtown court at the first appearance. Currently, they could ask for that transfer at any time, and also speaking from personal experience, that can result in some pretty substantial delays of some misdemeanor cases.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dale Koch, and I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County, and one of the courts that we staff is the Circuit Court located in the city of Gresham. By statute, for over 25 years, we are required to, at the defendant's choice, hold all proceedings for any misdemeanor or traffic offense that occurs east of 122nd in a court facility located within the city of Gresham. At this point, Multnomah County is looking at developing an East County Justice facility that would include as many as four courtrooms as opposed to the one that we presently have. And Ms. Moed, you'll be happy to know the Tap Dance Studio has now vacated the premises and we are the only occupants left in a building that would otherwise be condemned. But there's one courtroom there that we run both as a day court and a night court. As part of this process, we're looking at cleaning up some things in terms of the statute with the requirements for that court facility in Gresham. One is we never have held custody proceedings in that court facility. We don't have the holding facility or the security to do that. There's no intention to hold in custody proceedings in the new courthouse, but the statute wasn't clear on that. We wanted to clarify that. The second item, as Ms. Moed pointed out, is under the current statute, there's no timeline in which the defendant needs to make that determination as to whether they want to have their trial at the Gresham facility. So we get those requests well into the proceedings, which just then delay the proceeding and result in setting extra hearings. So we wanted to clarify that that choice needs to be made at the first appearance. And then the third part of the cleanup was just to recognize that if at any time during the proceeding somebody failed to appear for a court proceeding and therefore a warrant went out for their arrest, they would in essence forfeit their right to have their hearing in Gresham and it would move downtown with the rest of the proceedings. This affects approximately 40,000 cases a year that traffic and misdemeanor offenses that occur east of 122nd.
Any questions from the panel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the public hearing on 2568.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'll open a work session.
Okay, you're going to do that.
Okay. Floor hammer today.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2568 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Take the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
That's correct.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2156. Ms. Whitefield.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2156 would ratify the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact. That can be found in 42 United States Code Section 14616 and is essentially was essentially enacted by the federal Congress with the purpose of organizing an electronic information sharing system among the federal government and the states to exchange criminal history records for non-criminal justice purposes authorized by state or federal law. The example given in the United States Code is a background check for a governmental licensing and employment situation. This would enable Oregon to become a party state, and I'll let Ms. Whitfield explain what that means.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Patricia Whitfield, Section Director, Oregon State Police Identification Services Section, and I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2156, which does ratify the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact, and I'll refer to that as the compact through my testimony. The purpose of the compact is to permit the record retrieval and exchange of criminal history information for non-criminal justice purposes, as mentioned previously, for authorized states through a state law or federal law. And it facilitates this process by requiring the participating states and the FBI to provide all of their unsealed criminal history record information and make it available upon response to the request from the non-criminal justice agencies. And also, as mentioned, the types of checks are for employment, such as for the protection of children, vulnerable adults, elderly, disabled, as well as positions of public trust, securing facilities or information structures, and folks that have responsibilities dealing with fiduciary tasks. Fingerprint-based checks are required for an agency to gain access to the national criminal histories, and each state each state law governs how the information is used after it's obtained. The compact is a national program, and it eliminates the duplication of maintenance of these criminal history records by both the state and the FBI. It was first introduced and in Congress and later adopted in October of 1998, leaving it up to state legislators to ratify the compact in the individual states. The compact allows for uniform dissemination of policies among the states while still allowing each state to control and apply their dissemination laws. Oregon has participated in the Interstate Identification Index, also known as III, since 1983, and Oregon was also a participant in the National Fingerprint File, which is a pilot project in 1995, which demonstrated how record exchange through this process could work. So Oregon, having already been prepared and in those roles, we already meet all of the requirements to become a compact state. So there are no changes that are necessary for how we do our business with exchanging criminal histories for non-criminal justice purposes, and there are no costs associated with ratifying the compact. What the compact will change, however, for Oregon is our status. We are currently the only remaining national fingerprint file state that is not a ratified state. We're still under a memorandum of understanding with the FBI for the exchange. It would also provide Oregon an active voice to participate and give input on policy changes and record exchange processes. Oregon regulatory agencies such as Department of Human Services, Employment Department, Real Estate Agency, and a number of others will benefit by all of the states becoming compact states, in that under the compact, a state's criminal history repository and the FBI must share all of their criminal history information. And that would eliminate agencies getting only a partial record for their non-criminal justice safety-related decisions. An example of having received a partial record would be, for instance, an arrest without a disposition. Maybe the disposition hadn't been received from the court, it wasn't reported, or perhaps the subject didn't show up for court and the charge was not disposed of. They might be trying to avoid being held accountable. Those are things that the state agencies, the authorized agencies making those decisions, would not have the ability to see if a state were not a compact state. To date, 19 states have independently ratified the compact. Four additional states, including Oregon, are considering that. And with the increase and the expanded need to do background checks for non-criminal justice purposes, we believe that it is most beneficial to the citizens of Oregon to ratify the compact in Oregon and support this national program. That concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Representative Thatcher.
Okay. Is this available only to government agencies, or is it also available to subcontractors of government agencies, such as those providing service to the disabled, you know, through DHS?
Representative Thatcher, Representative Barker, the state legislature, Oregon legislature, determines who is an authorized agency. There are a number of state agencies that currently have access. The only non-state entities that I believe have access currently are, there are transit districts throughout the state that have a statute in place that allows them to do background checks. Each entity that's given the authorization must go through training and certification to know how to obtain and use that information, because it is highly confidential. So it's up to the legislature to determine who has access.
In your experience, maybe this isn't a question you can answer, but in your experience, has there been a cost associated with accessing this system as far as getting that information?
Representative Thatcher, yes, there is a cost. We charge a fee to do a fingerprint-based background check through the Oregon State Police, and the FBI also charges a fee to those agencies for the background check.
Okay. Do you have an estimate of what that is, just to get an idea? Just curious.
Yes, sorry. Representative Thatcher, there are various fees. We've just recently increased our fee for that fingerprint process, and it is currently $28 for the Oregon check, and it is $24 for the FBI check. If the applicant that's being checked happens to be a volunteer, there is a reduced fee of $18 for the FBI check.
Just to clarify, you're saying the person getting checked or requesting the check, if they were a volunteer, gets a reduced fee?
The agency that is submitting the check, okay. If they indicate that it's for a volunteer position,
I see. Okay.
Then there is that reduced fee.
Thank you.
And does the state police actually do the fingerprinting, or do you have to bring in a fingerprint card ready to go for that?
Mr. Chair, we do provide public fingerprinting. We don't necessarily have to do the fingerprinting in this case. We provide training to agencies that might need that if they can, if they choose to do that on their own. Otherwise, they would typically contact local law enforcement, see if they have the resources to do that, or I believe there are a few private fingerprinting companies throughout the state that they can utilize.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Representative McPherson.
Ms. Whitfield, I'm still trying to get oriented into what's going on here exactly. There's a system that people can access to do a criminal background check when they're making employment decisions, for example. And by being part of this compact, we're agreeing to exchange information with other law enforcement agencies so that there's a larger database that then other users can then access. Is that what's going on here?
Representative McPherson, Mr. Chair, this is an exchange with non-criminal justice, non-law enforcement agencies. There's the law enforcement side of criminal histories, and then there's the ever-growing non-criminal justice side for employment and certification type of checks. And law enforcement has pretty much complete access to all the information and can do so either through a fingerprint arrest for a positive ID or a name check through the infrastructure for the National Crime Information Center. They can do a name check through a computer. Non-criminal justice purposes do not have that same type of access. They must do a fingerprint check so that they know positively that's the person that they're checking on, and they must be approved through the legislative body to have the authority. Once they have that authority, then they go through the process to be trained up. But yes, they use the criminal history for making decisions for employment and licensing, certification, that sort of thing.
For the question, Mr. Chair, but there's, this piece of legislation ratifies a compact that is among a number of states. So I'm trying to understand what's the interstate dimension to what's going on here. Because I mean, I understand what you've described is that we have a criminal justice system that builds a criminal histories on people who've had history of that sort, and then we allow people who with certain authority then who are outside the criminal justice system to access that information for example, employment decisions. But this is an interstate issue here because we're ratifying something that expands into other states. So what, how does that fit into this mix here? Is it that we're agreeing that Oregon's criminal history will then be available to people who in Arizona who want to check on a criminal, see if there's an Oregon criminal history for somebody that they're considering employing? Is that what's happening?
Representative McPherson, Mr. Chair, yes. Oregon law already provides for our records to be disseminated to other authorized parties. This is not changing how we disseminate our records or how we make them available. A nationwide check, let me go, if I could just briefly explain a little bit more detail about the III and the NFF, this building of the improvement of the exchange of criminal histories. Each state used to, and still does, maintain their own records within their own state. And for years, we've contributed to the FBI, so there was this building of a nationwide criminal history rap sheet. And in seeing that that's not as efficient as it could be, these programs were put in place several years ago, III, Interstate Identification Index, and National Fingerprint File, where a contributing state, Oregon, submits one set of fingerprints to the FBI. It's positively identified and matched to a record. Then any subsequent arrests are no longer necessary to send to the FBI, so they're building a duplicate record on the nationwide level. Rather, they're placing a pointer back to Oregon. So anyone having access to a national record would then be able to come back to Oregon and get the record from Oregon. And that would take place in each of the states that are participating in III and NFF. The compact is actually the body that's overseeing the exchange of these records. And it's sort of the icing on the top of the cake, the final step in the processes that we've been involved in to make this record exchange more expedient, more efficient. Records are available now through those fingerprints, through the FBI, and a state's own laws will decide how the record can be used and how it will be disseminated. Oregon law currently and has for as long as I'm aware of offered to any authorized agency the entire record. So it's not just the convictions, but it's arrests that don't have a disposition as well. It's the full record. I don't know if that answered your question.
We're getting there, but okay. Give me a little more rope here, I guess. So by passing this legislation, we're ratifying a compact that commits us to participate in the exchange among all the ratifying states, so that we're agreeing that we'll make our full criminal histories, including arrests without disposition, available when somebody in another state makes a request of the Oregon system?
Representative McPherson, yes, that's correct, and we currently do that. We currently do provide that information. So it's the compact ratification is not a change in that respect. It does, however, allow Oregon to participate on the committee, on the compact, in a way that we can provide input on any changes to that kind of exchange.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My understanding, all you're wanting to do is just remove the MOU that you have and just tighten the whole thing up.
Representative Olson, that's correct.
Right.
I just have one other question. If I'm going to check somebody and for insurance license or something, so we fingerprint them, what happens to those fingerprints?
Chair Barker, currently there are very few, maybe 6 agencies in the state of Oregon that their fingerprints for non-criminal justice purposes are maintained at the state police. All the others are processed through the state police and the FBI and returned back to the agency for destroying. So they're searched and then they're returned.
Okay, and which agencies do you retain those on?
Mr. Chair, it would be for private security officers. Wait a minute, I didn't have my notes with me on that.
I'm sorry, catch up on that.
I'm losing my thought. DPSST, private security, polygraph examiners, those types of positions.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on 2156. Open a work session.
All right, Mr. Chair. We take the House Bill 2156 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher will carry that one. Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 2968. And we have Kelly Sky.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2968 is here at the request of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It would increase the value of property that must be taken for all degrees of theft. There are -1 amendments. They would exclude the aggravated theft in the first degree and leave that amount untouched. On your SMS, I did a little table for you so you could see where we are with the current law and what House Bill 2968 would do as far as increasing those values.
Thank you, Ms. Sky.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Sky, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and this is our bill. It's an idea that came to us from one of our members, an attorney at the Public Defender's Office, Ryan Scott. And one of the things that we had asked our members to think about were changes in the law that may save money. So we're bringing this as a money-saving idea. The idea is that I believe it was 1987 was the last time that these amounts were changed. And so what we did was we went onto the Oregon Department of Revenue website. They have a consumer price index calculator so that you can put in the amount of an item, the cost of an item, what it was worth in 1987, what you would have to pay for that now. And then we just adjusted all of these amounts according to that. And quite frankly, when I ran this yesterday, I had the wrong year, and I put in the 1991 figures instead of 1987. But if you put in 1991, what you would have paid $50 for then, you will now pay $71.59. So 1987 would be a little bit more, which is about the adjustment here from $50 to $75. And each adjustment was made in that manner. The Dash 1 amendment arises from conversations with the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and they decided not to oppose this bill. They are fine with it, with the exception that they asked us to leave aggravated theft at the current value, which is $10,000, and we were agreeable to that. So that's where the Dash 1 amendment comes from. And this is the rare bill where you're going to have the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I don't think they're here to support it, but they do not object, and I get that straight from Mr. Berry himself. So we think that this is a good way to save money in that it will reduce many felonies to misdemeanors, which reduces the cost of providing an attorney. It reduces the cost of prosecution, especially decreases the cost of incarceration, especially in light of the fact that since 1987 we've enacted the repeat property offender mandatory minimum sentences. So a lot of people who might fall within that may not fall within that. So this is a way to save money and to just keep the law up to date with the intent of the legislature in 1987.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Carl Stecker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County, appearing here today on behalf of the ODAA, and in fact conceding, as Ms. Skye has represented, the association has no position with respect to this bill and would concur in the amendments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing and open the work session. We have an amendment. Move the amendment?
I do. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 2968.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
And then additionally, I would like to make a motion to move House Bill 2968 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Olson, McCurry. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2966. Mr. Blashman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 2966 would broaden the class of persons eligible to receive benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. The bill as written it broadens the class to include domestic partners. There are Dash 1 amendments, however, that would make this a little bit more of a reciprocal benefits type of bill that would enable the law enforcement officer to name a designee, and that would conceivably be anyone that they chose to be a designee. So there are Dash 1 amendments to this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Delishman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Delishman representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. For those of you who are not familiar with this particular fund, I assume the three police officers are, but I'm not sure that everybody is. This fund was established several sessions ago in the unfortunate event if a public safety officer was killed in the line of duty or permanently disabled. The fund, as it currently sets, establishes several different aspects as far as benefits, including an insurance policy within the first 7 days of the incident for those expenses that would be incurred in a funeral and other making other instant decisions that had to be made in that situation. Also provides for potentially college scholarships or grants to the children of a public safety officer, and also deals a little bit with insurance, health insurance policies, if in fact there was coverage prior to the death, and that policy would then be terminated on the death of the officer, then it would assist in paying health insurance to go on. So with that history, we'd ask that this bill be introduced, and we are supporting the Dash 1 amendments. There are circumstances or particular designees that are not currently covered under the statute. A couple examples that I could give you could be, in fact, an elderly grandparent who is, in fact, the sole living relative of the officer that would be left with the responsibility, of course, of taking care of the arrangements, the funeral arrangements. There are longstanding relationships of roommates. Be very clear about that. Someone who, in fact, is the only person that's resided with that person for the last 20, 25 years would have to make those arrangements. The other one that I was thinking about was potentially a family member who could, in fact, be maybe a disabled person, a niece or nephew in which you've taken the responsibility of taking over the care of that particular person, and they would be left without any benefits. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Go ahead, Ms. Representative Thatcher.
Yes, I haven't quite formulated the question, but let me see if I can do this on the fly. I'm picturing, okay, you said that it would continue health coverage if it was in place before the tragic event. So a roommate would be eligible for, you're saying if the roommate was covered, for instance, under the family member, the niece or the elderly grandparent was covered under this person's health care package before, they would continue that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, actually the health insurance piece is directly formulated to deal with minor children. So in this particular case, it would not cover that. The real benefit here on this extension to designee is what basically amounts to the component that deals with insurance. It's like a life insurance policy.
Life insurance. Okay, thank you.
Great. Representative McPherson?
Mr. DeLeishman, what's the source of funding for the benefits that are provided out of the memorial fund?
Historically, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, historically it was dollars that were derived from the uniform fines and assessments. I hope I'm using the right term. It has been in and out of the governor's general fund budget a couple of times, so currently I believe it's a combination of funding, but I think it originally derived, and the dollars that are in there now are from the uniform fines and assessments.
Okay. Further question, if I could. I guess I'm trying to understand the Dash 1 amendments, because the initial bill would extend to domestic partners the benefits that would have been provided to a spouse, but now it would be broadened so it's people who are not in a domestic partner relationship, maybe people who are in another generation and within the family. I guess I'm trying to understand. Generally, we're at our constitutional obligation under the Tanner case to be extending state governmental benefits to same-sex domestic partners, but that wouldn't extend to people who are in a different generation. I guess I'm trying to understand the context here.
Is that a question of me?
It's a leading question.
It kind of faded off at the end there, and I wasn't sure whether
I was looking at a note here, but I'm trying to understand what's how a designee who's other than a domestic partner sort of comes into entitlement for benefits here.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, actually, I just saw the Dash 1 amendments this morning for the first time, but my understanding is that there's an attempt to capture those folks who wouldn't historically just fit the category of domestic partner, that in fact there was an attempt to broaden it to capture those folks that in fact probably derived their livelihood or were being under the care that were not a direct family member, for example, a child or a married spouse of the officer, and that was the attempt in the Dash 1s.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and open the work session.
No. Well, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to accept the -1 amendments into House Bill 2966.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
And then additionally, I would also move that 2966 be moved to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Representative
McPherson? Aye. Representative Olson? Aye. Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
I don't carry that one. Okay. We're waiting for a witness on 3011, but so we'll move on to a work session on, or no, we can open a public hearing on 2976. Mr. Stecker, Ms. Fuller, and Schlesinger.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Shaney Fuller, and I'm here representing the Oregon Child Support Program with the Department of Justice. I also have Carl Stecker and Conchetta Schlesinger with the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I want to give you a little bit of background, but otherwise we'll hand it over to them to discuss the technical aspects of this bill. The Oregon Child Support Program is made up of the Division of Child Support with the Department of Justice and the District Attorney offices throughout the state. It is the mission of the Oregon Child Support Program to enhance the well-being of children through the provision of child support services. We have several tools that we use to secure support for a family, and one of those is criminal non-support. This is a tool primarily used by the district attorneys, which is why they're here to talk about the technical aspects today. Attached to my testimony, I have also provided you with the enforcement principles for the child support program. In general, we take a stair-step approach in enforcing child support, and it is really our goal to enter into a payment agreement with the obligor to get money flowing to the family. Criminal non-support is the top of the staircase, if you will, and it is a last-ditch effort to get support for that family and is used only when all other remedies have failed. And it's clear that the obligor is able but simply unwilling to pay, and it's at that point that we use that remedy in order to secure support for the family. I have spoken with Kelly Skye with OCDLA about this concept. While OCDLA opposes the bill in concept, they particularly oppose lines 15 and 16 of page 1 that applies a higher standard of proof to this affirmative defense than would normally apply, and we have no objection to removing that last sentence of paragraph 3 on lines 15 and 16. So with that, I will hand it over to Mr. Stecker and Ms. Schlesinger.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carl Stecker. Again, I'm a Marion County Deputy District Attorney, and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The association has proposed this bill in response to a case that came out of the Court of Appeals, State versus Newsman, at 194 or at 351 last August. And in particular, there are several elements to the crime of criminal non-support. It is an extraordinary remedy, as indicated by Ms. Fuller, one which is in fact only used in probably a few hundred cases at most annually, in spite of the fact that there are over 250,000 cases on the Oregon child support system. So it's left for those who are truly recalcitrant and neglectful of their children. And the difficulty is that sometimes, by virtue of their steadfast refusal to pay for a prolonged period of time, any information about them is somewhat remote and not proximate in time. And the elements that need to be shown are that they're the parent, lawful guardian, or other person charged with the support of a child under the age of 18, and that they neglected and refused without lawful excuse to provide support for that child. And the difficulty that comes is that it requires the state to prove a negative. We have to anticipate and therefore rebut or prove affirmatively under the current law any aspect that may serve as a lawful excuse. And particularly with respect to information in the medical realm, federal law such as HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability Act, has hampered our acquisition of an investigation of those kinds of circumstance. And so as a result of these types of things, it becomes increasingly hard to get to the information. And this is information that's uniquely within the knowledge of the criminal defendant to begin with. So it would, we believe it's appropriate to shift that burden to an affirmative defense, that then the defendant can come forth and show that he may have any of manifold numbers of lawful excuses in the event that he in fact feels that in good faith he has that. However, for the state to attempt to anticipate the vast panoply of potential defenses becomes very, very difficult, as illustrated by Newsman. In any event, so we concur with Ms. Fuller and Ms. apparently the OCDLA's request that the standard be reduced as from what drafted in the bill as a clear and convincing evidence to the preponderance standard, which is applied to all other affirmative defenses under ORS 161055. So in any event, there are a few trials on these cases. Most of these cases, when we do locate an individual, we enter into a diversionary agreement with probationary terms. Obviously, our mission here is to get people to pay what they legitimately owe to their children. And so we would ask and encourage your passage of this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't real clear. Is lawful excuse defined, or is that to be defined through the Department of Justice?
Well, Representative Chair, Representative Thatcher, the lawful excuse has been defined by statutory law as something of not of the defendant's own making, in essence, or an excuse or some reason beyond his reasonable control. And there is some case law with respect to that under the number that have been appealed over time, and the body case law has arisen.
I have a follow-up then. Thank you. I know earlier this session there was a bill that would pretty much capture those who were independent contractors, self-employed individuals who have used that as an excuse to not pay child support. So not of his own making, would that include now those who decided to become self-employed or independent contractors? Now they would not have a lawful excuse to, not pay their child support? Just wondering if that would capture that.
Representative Barker, Representative Thatcher, I don't know that one who is self-employed has a lawful excuse, because they clearly have the ability to pay if they're self-employed, or they have some ability. In the ideal case, we can show that they have a lifestyle or some means that enables their acquisition of a reasonably good standard of living such that they could easily support their children. Again, these cases don't often come that way. We had one not too long ago, an example of the kind of case that comes out is found in the Bigelow decision, which also came down last year. That was reversed on other grounds, but the defendant in that case was an interstate truck driver whose process was unable to reach by virtue of the fact that this person was traveling in an interstate mode, constantly moving from Bigelow, actually not moving, but in many instances, these cases represent people that move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction so that conventional civil remedies don't work. And in the case of independent contractors, those folks are not amenable normally to income withholding unless they have a partner or somebody else who would take responsibility. And so very often these cases result in initially at least a contempt prosecution before the circuit court. A contempt of court has some
punitive types of remedies, but those are the vast majority of cases that the district attorneys handle. Again, these cases, criminal non-support has a felony status, and it is reserved for the worst of the offenders.
Another question. I think it says, does it... I'm trying to figure out where the not of his own making law is. I'm just wondering if we really want to have the... Is that in the bill?
I was trying to find it. No,
okay,
I think
thank you.
That again comes out of the case law.
Okay. I came from here.
See the...
Defendant.
I was just looking if I could get you.
Okay. I just want to make sure we weren't getting sexist here.
Yeah. We have it. So.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Conchetta Schlesinger here on behalf as well of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I just concur with what everyone else has said.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we do oppose House Bill 2976. And I did speak with, I'm of course only remembering her first name, Lonnie, with the Child Support Enforcement Division. And we do have two objections to this bill. One is just changing the burden of proof. And shifting it on to the defendant. And the second is that after you change that burden of proof, you're making it a higher burden of proof than for any other affirmative defense. And so we do appreciate the willingness to allow that burden of proof to be what is defined in the affirmative defense statute, and that is a preponderance of evidence. That's the same burden of proof that is currently used for guilty except for insanity, renunciation, extreme emotional disturbance, and all the other affirmative defenses that are used, and we think that that's appropriate to apply in this case as well. But the general idea of shifting the burden of proof is something that I wanted to discuss as well, because although I believe that the people who are here do probably use this as an extraordinary remedy and only for the worst of the worst, there is nothing in the statute that says that it only applies to those people. The statute can be used to apply to anybody who does not pay within a given period of time. And so I think it's important that we not make the law to apply to the worst of the worst. When it really applies to everyone, it's important for it to remain fair. And I did read the Newsman case yesterday after speaking with the person from the District Attorneys Association. And what it says is, and what all of the cases that define lawful excuse say is in fact that a lawful excuse would be some condition not of the defendant's own making which prevents them from being able to provide support. However, what those cases say is that what a prosecutor must prove in order to prove one of these cases are three things. One is that there's a court mandate to pay. Two is that there's an ability to generate income. And in fact, wages have been earned sometime during the period in question. And three, that that they've made a payment in any amount. So it's not that the prosecutor needs to prove that there's no possible excuse. It's that they just need to prove that they're required to pay and that they actually have an ability to pay, have made some money during the time period. The Newsman case was overturned not because the prosecutor couldn't foresee the defense that was presented by the defendant. It was overturned because, in that case, the Support Enforcement Division's file had nothing in it. They testified that they must have done some investigation to determine that this person had an ability to pay, but they had no evidence to present whatsoever. The file was empty. In that case, the court said, well, that's not enough to convince somebody that this person was actually able to pay. You have to have done something. And So I somewhat disagree with the state's representation as to that case. We don't agree with shifting the burden onto the defendant to prove as an affirmative defense. We think that that the way the case law is, it allows a state to prove it by proving that they had an ability to pay and that they made any payments. In fact, a recent case that was just released, State versus Eagle, it's a slip opinion at this point because it was released April 20th of this year, and it's a very similar case factually, except that in that case, it was a two-year period where the person didn't pay, and they had proof that the person had money to pay because they had made a payment just prior to the two-year period where they stopped. And so they were able to show that they certainly had ability to pay because they had just made a payment and then they stopped for 2 years. And in that case, the court said, we're not going to overturn it. That they upheld that conviction. So I'm willing to answer any questions that you have.
Hey, well, one of the things they brought up that was brought up was the HIPAA. You know, in recent years, that's really tightened that down. So I could see where some unscrupulous person who doesn't want to take care of his obligations to his own children might try to use that to hide behind. And so I can see where this might be beneficial in those kind of cases. Just
Chair Barker, what I would say to that is HIPAA has made it harder to get to medical records. However, any prosecutor can get medical records in a prosecution, and they do it routinely to get evidence before the grand jury and also for trial. All they have to do is subpoena those records. And while HIPAA has changed the way that we, both prosecution and defense, go about getting medical records, it hasn't made them less available. It's just made us go through a couple extra hoops.
Further questions?
Yes. I do. Ms. Sky, I guess I'm a little confused. You discussed the issue of State versus Eagle in the two-year period where he made the original payment, and then all of a sudden he doesn't for the next 2 years. How does that apply to this whole thing?
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, in that case, what the court said is because you have established that this person had an ability to make money and, in fact, had money and paid it on a given date, that fulfilled the requirement that the prosecutor show that the person had an ability to generate income and, in fact, made money, that there was a presumption that because that person, say it was January 1st when they made the payment and then for 2 years after that didn't, because that person had the money and made that payment just prior to this two-year period, then we can presume they still had the ability to pay. You just have to show that they actually made money and had the ability to pay at some point. In Newsman, there was no evidence whatsoever because the actual child support file and the court talks about the file in that case when the caseworker took the stand, the file was empty. They didn't show that they'd ever look to see if the person, because one of the things that the case law says, check to see if they're incarcerated. If they've been in prison all this time, you can't prosecute them. Check to, and it has some other things to check. And their file didn't even show that they'd done any of that. And that was why the court said this isn't enough to sustain a conviction. You have to be able to present some evidence. Whereas in Eagle, they said, you did present some evidence. You showed that he made a payment just prior to this two-year period. And that's enough to presume that they had an ongoing ability to pay and they didn't pay. Does that clarify?
Yeah, I'm pretty confused on that one.
I'm sorry.
Sure. I mean, I'm thinking myself, so you got a two-year period, he hasn't paid at all. I mean, I would think that he'd be in violation of the statute. Myself.
And Chair Barker, Representative Olson, in that case, he was.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, he was because they were able to say, yeah, we've seen him pay before, and then all of a sudden he didn't pay for 2 years. So that supports a conviction. Whereas in Newsman, they had nothing. So they had no way of showing that, you know, maybe this person was in prison for 15 years and had no way of paying, or maybe they were disabled and, you know, in a hospital for 15 years and had no way of paying. They had nothing to show that this person had an ability to pay.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on this bill, and the as I see a problem here is sometimes in a divorce that's pretty bitter, the kids get caught in. I mean, you get somebody that doesn't want to pay because he may think his wife's spending on the new boyfriend's car or TV or something, and you run into those kind of things. And when when the obligated parent is not making those payments, and we're making them for them as taxpayers and picking up all the other picking up those costs, and the children are the one who suffers in this. So I would like to help get that straightened out. With regard to the burden of proof, I'd like to move it without an amendment today, and we'll have an amendment when it gets to the full committee, and then we can insert the amendment at that time, withdrawing that last sentence on line 14 and 15.
And Mr. Chair, I will support moving the bill out on the understanding that we'll make that amendment, but that would be essential to me.
Okay, thank you.
And Ms. also, I do like the idea of shifting the persuasion for burden of proof.
So someone needs to make a motion.
You want to make an official motion?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I move, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2976 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation on the understanding that it will be amended in full.
Okay. Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative McPherson, carry that one. Okay, sorry. Yeah, okay. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3011.
Judge Koch,
Sybil Hebb, and we'll have a couple panels come up, and Terry Quinteros.
Chair Barker, excuse me, I know Judy Marins from Representative March's office is here as well.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if she wanted to.
Okay. Go ahead, please come up, and we'll put you in the next week. Yeah, if we could.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.
Good morning. I am Judy Marins. I'm a legislative aide to Representative Steve March, who sponsored the bill. We just wanted to introduce it formally from the office. It was introduced at the request of the Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women. And we recognize that fatality review teams are presently allowed under law, but the need for and the focus of our bill is to provide the confidentiality of the records that are collected. Without these provisions, police and prosecutors in particular aren't able to fully participate in the studies that we want to do, and so that we can prevent future fatalities. And of course, the victims are understandably unwilling to share their experience if they believe the particulars of their lives and their cases are going to be made known. There were some concerns, and we've offered an amendment, and I'd just like to turn this over to Sybil Hebb, who will more fully explain the bill and the amendments.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm an attorney and legislative advocate with the Oregon Law Center. The Law Center, as many of you know, is a civil legal services provider, and we have a statewide presence offering legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. And the reason that we're interested in the bill, or that the Law Center is interested in the bill, is that we provide services based on sort of community priority assessments, and we try to make sure that our services are meeting the needs of low-income Oregonians across the state. The issue of domestic violence and sexual assault has been identified as one of the highest needs, one of the highest priorities across the state. And so we have prioritized those services. As we have begun providing those services, we've learned a great deal more about the complexity of this problem and about the need for a very coordinated response to prevent domestic violence and to address it when it does occur. And we've also, unfortunately, learned about the fatality that domestic violence can provide. statewide. Leon Medeiros is here and will give you more information about the statistics, but on average there are between 18 and 20 deaths per year as a result of domestic violence, and we know nationally that it is the leading cause of death of pregnant women. And so this is an issue that we're clearly not on top of, and we clearly haven't done enough to respond to this issue well enough. So we're interested in this bill because we feel it will provide communities with an ability to take a look at cases and determine in a very close way and determine what we could have done possibly to have prevented the fatality. I'll also indicate that I'm speaking on behalf of the Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women. As Judy mentioned, that group is supportive of this bill and was a requester of the bill. The Legislative Alliance is a statewide grassroots network of domestic violence and sexual assault advocates, basically working at the programs that are doing this work on a 24-hour basis across the state. So I'll give just a quick brief summary of what the bill would do. It's based on current legislation in Oregon and in other states that provide a means by which communities can come together to investigate child abuse fatalities. And that legislation was passed a number of sessions ago here in Oregon to require communities to come together to look at how they could have better responded to have prevented the child fatality. And what we'd like to do is to allow communities to look at domestic violence fatalities in the same way. So we used our legislation as a model. We also looked at other legislation in other states and consulted with the National Domestic Violence Fatality Review Initiative and took some sample legislation from them. We sent our bill out to other parties to seek comment, and we did receive some feedback from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association indicating that they had some concerns about the confidentiality provisions. They were worried that that our bill would end up limiting in some way their currently available discovery options. And so in response to that concern, we had the dash one amendments drafted to make it clear that this law is not intended and does not in any way limit otherwise currently available discovery options. And that did address that concern of the Trial Lawyers Association. They may have others that I don't know about. We hope that you can move forward on this bill with its current language. We heard in talking to other agencies across the state and asking them what would help them to participate in this review process, we heard consistently that agencies were concerned, they were nervous about participating in a process that did not have confidentiality. Every agency has its own procedures and processes by which they respond to requests for information. They didn't want to have their information going to some independent other organization that had different rules or perhaps different processes. And so we heard consistently that agencies would not be willing to participate unless there was that protection. So we feel it's really crucial to the purpose of the law, and it's why we can't do this as a community on a voluntary basis right now, because without that protection, we simply don't, agencies are too nervous. The two other major benefits of the bill are that when a community does decide to get together to do a review in the tragic occurrence of a fatality, this bill will provide some protocols and procedures by which that review should be conducted so that we know when agencies or when communities do this across the state, they're doing it with some consistency, and we can then get a better handle on what their results are, and we have a better sense of trust in the recommendations that they come forward with. The bill also allows in an anonymized way, which I think is not a word, but in a way that doesn't reveal the identity of the victims or the families involved, provides a way for the local reviews to submit some data to a statewide group that can then help us to keep better track of how often this is happening and what some of the factors were. So we really appreciate your support, and we would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Judge.
For those of you that have the same kind of memory I have, I'm Dale Kosh, and I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. But I have a couple of other roles I also fill that may give some background for this. I am the vice president of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and I also presently serve as the co-chair of the steering committee for the National Judicial Institutes on Domestic Violence, which is funded through the Violence Against Women office providing training to judges all over the nation on issues of domestic violence. So I come with that background to this discussion as well. I'm here speaking in support of this bill. This issue came to my attention about a year and a half ago when we had another unfortunate instance of a domestic violence homicide in Multnomah County where a mother was killed in front of her children. And it particularly struck me in that I had just that day signed a warrant for the accused for failing to appear at a court appearance. And in looking at the file then, I discovered that there was also a restraining order that was presently outstanding, a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order outstanding against the defendant. And in looking at it, it appeared that he had had other contacts with the both civil and criminal justice system in Multnomah County. I had a conversation with the district attorney and with the head of our Family Violence Coordinating Council in Multnomah County, and we determined that we would try to have a fatality review. We, in fact, conducted that review. We found in that process, though, although everyone was very open in participating, that they all were there somewhat reluctantly in terms of the information that they could provide in looking at the circumstances of that homicide and the circumstances of the family, really, that led up to the homicide, where the system may have effectively intervened before they got to the point of the homicide occurring. And that was really the impetus for us asking and actually approaching Representative March to see if he would introduce this bill. One of the things that was clear in terms of the need for confidentiality, and that's really the primary component of this, that sure, we could do most of the rest of the stuff without that provision. But what makes that provision so necessary from, I think, the court's perspective is without that provision of confidentiality, the police and the district attorney's office are not going to be comfortable with criminal defense lawyers participating in the review. Without the criminal defense lawyers participating in the review, then the judge is going to feel, the court's going to feel uncomfortable participating in a panel and in a review where both sides aren't represented because of the need to maintain impartiality by the courts. And the courts are absolutely an essential part of this discussion. We oftentimes have had several interactions with the family, and one of the obligations the court has, and the entire criminal justice system has, is to continually evaluate our system to assure that when somebody comes to seek assistance, that our intervention has actually reduced the possibility of violence as opposed to inadvertently increase the possibility of violence. And there's a lot of history around this country of instances where people have sought out the assistance of the courts and actually just found themselves in a worse situation rather than a better situation. So the need to continually do that evaluation on a regular basis of the service we're providing is absolutely essential to safety of the parents and children that come before us for assistance. So that's why I speak in support of this bill. The other thing I would just point out is that this bill is permissive. It does not require any jurisdiction to form a domestic violence fatality review committee, but just allows them to do that. And I would also, the last point I would make is Oregon will not be unique in having this type of legislation. Washington, California, Nevada, just to speak of some that adjoin our states, already have this legislation in place. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
I just have a comment. I just feel so strongly about this. I just think that we, as a legislature, want to see the government be more effective, and this is one way where we're actually allowing a process where we can save lives, where you can identify the gaps and find, prevent things from happening that maybe, like you said, could have been facilitated inadvertently before just because the process wasn't set up right, and I think this is very important to set up. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next we have Connie Gallagher, Liam Medeiros, and Terry Fincaros. Please go ahead.
Great. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Leanne Medeiros, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Human Services, Health Services, and I manage a grant to collect statewide data on intimate partner violence. And I'm here to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3011, which, as you know, would provide statutory authority to conduct domestic violence fatality reviews in Oregon. And as part of our project to collect data related to this problem, we've reviewed homicides in Oregon for 7 years, from 1997 through 2003. And during that time period, we determined that 124 homicides in Oregon were committed due to intimate partner violence. And that accounts for 46% of all the female homicides and 4% of all male homicides. We also found that women are almost 5 times as likely than men to be killed in an intimate partner homicide event. Also, sadly, we found that 40% of the homicide victims had dependent children living with them at the time of the death. Also, in 2000, our office had the opportunity to pilot some domestic violence fatality reviews in Oregon. We were asked by the Governor's Council to pilot those activities and collect data regarding how participants felt that information, that project was valued. They felt, according to our evaluation results, they felt the process was valuable in sharing information, increasing communication, identifying system gaps and weaknesses. It's strange. And most importantly, in generating very concrete recommendations for systems improvement. I also want to say that they strongly supported legislation to protect communication during these exchanges of information. And with that, I would say that I hope Oregon can join the other 33 states in the country currently conducting domestic violence fatality review. I believe it's a very important mechanism for us to identify system gaps and generate recommendations to save lives in Oregon. So the Department of Human Services encourages your support of House Bill 3011, and I am happy to answer any questions you might have, and I thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the administrator of Crime Victims Assistance Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3011, in part due to my role as the former co-chair of the State Child Fatality Review Team. As the co-chair, I did have the opportunity to see the benefit of both the state review of fatalities as well as the local review of fatalities, whether that those be child abuse fatalities or domestic violence fatalities. Through the local reviews, the local professionals are able to have an opportunity, as you heard from the other witnesses, to review the circumstances of a death, the elements of a death, which otherwise they would not have an opportunity to bring together so that they could recognize what might be unnoticed elements of the death, or they might not be able to recognize a pattern in their community. Once a group has an opportunity to look at single deaths, but also aggregate deaths in their community, that enables them to analyze the data. And again, as you've heard, they can adjust policies, they can develop focused prevention strategies, they can also set priorities for intervention that are going to be much more effective than they'd be able to do if they did not have this opportunity. Authorization of local reviews is a positive step towards reducing preventable deaths. With that, I would encourage your support of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Terry Quintos. I'm the Program Director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety. We are a group of crime survivors who are working with the Western Prison Project to help create criminal justice reform, and we have a very simple goal. We want to help prevent future crime and violence. Through shelters, crisis lines, and informal network systems, I have literally worked with thousands of domestic violence survivors throughout the years in the state of Oregon. And Crime Survivors for Community Safety strongly supports House Bill 3011 because it has a broad, inclusive definition of which fatalities will potentially be reviewed. The teams will be multidisciplinary, since the broad community response is essential for effectively responding to violence. It does allow for some privacy of the victims and their family. And it calls for statewide recommendations that are relevant to both rural and urban communities, which we find very important. It's also a very important way in which we can help honor the victim and their family and their community members by gaining a better understanding of domestic violence homicides and preventing future violence. And again, I urge you to support House Bill 3011.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Public hearing on House Bill 3011. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2322. Ms. Vaughn, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We first heard testimony on House Bill 2322 on February 17th. The original bill would expand assault in the first degree to include intentionally or knowingly causing serious physical injury to a child under 14 years of age. At that time, we heard testimony both in support and opposition, and one of the things that I did after talking with Mr. Hummel from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and Mr. Sparks from the Oregon District Attorneys Association was I submitted some amendments. What the amendments would do would lower the age of the victim to under 13 years of age, just a little bit younger. And the idea really was that once a child starts to go through puberty, speaking quite frankly, they are able to defend themselves in a way that a prepubescent child would not be able to. And so the idea was to kind of draw that line at 12 and under. Additionally, we added a requirement that the victim had to be at least 5 years younger than the defendant. And the primary reason that we did that was to avoid the result of a schoolyard fight ending up with a young person charged with ballot measure 11 crimes. And so the idea is to put in an age cushion there that did not exist in the initial bill. Finally, an amendment was added to allow for an increased post-prison supervision. That was at the request of Mr. Sparks, who talked about the fact that oftentimes these violent perpetrators against children will move into homes either, once they're released from prison, will move back into homes with the child victim themselves or with new children, and the ODAA wanted to see a longer term of post-prison supervision so that an officer, a parole officer, would be keeping an eye on where that defendant was living.
Okay, do we have copies of those amendments?
You should.
Okay.
It's right there.
Okay, just dash one is all we want.
Yes.
Okay. And then also, we were talking about the down to age 12 or 12 and below.
Right, but it's 13 and under. Under 13 okay. Is the I language see. In the statute, so it's 12 and under.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I ask questions of counsel here so I can
yes,
get
please.
Kind of reoriented here. If I remember when this came up for hearing, it was over 2 months ago now. This would expand an existing offense by increasing the age that is involved, right?
Representative McPherson and members of the committee, that is correct.
And it would... if I recall right, there's a hierarchy in which if you use a weapon, then it's a that level of seriousness already, but this would extend it so that it's without using a weapon, right?
That is correct.
Okay. How does there's no fiscal impact statement on this yet, because this is expanding a Measure 11 offense, as I recall.
That's correct, although I will say this. I have been in contact with Mr. Bliss at the Criminal Justice Commission, and my recollection is there is going to be no fiscal impact for the first biennium, and then I think the first two biennia. And the reason for that is that this behavior is currently assault 2. So that would be a 70-month sentence. This is making it a 90-month prison sentence, and so my understanding is that any fiscal impact won't even be felt for 6 years, essentially. So this will come out with a no fiscal.
Because the time horizon in our fiscal reports is just the next two biennia.
Correct.
Also, Council, Mr. Chair, I'm curious, how did you come up with the 5-year difference?
Well, that was in conversations with ODAA and Mr. Hummel. Again, I think the primary desire is to exclude the schoolyard site, really. But we didn't want to do over 18 as the cutoff because there are, you know, potentially underage parents that could abuse an infant child, and that is something that certainly this bill is intended to capture. And so we didn't want to make it an 18 and over. But like I said, the primary reason for that 5-year age difference was to keep the schoolyard site out of assault in the first degree.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of some of the 16-year-olds. You get a 13-year-old. I realize that's only 3 years difference and everything, but there's some 16-year-olds out there that are pretty good size and very mature and can do some damage to a 13-year-old.
Representative Wilson, I don't disagree. I guess the idea was to narrow this sufficiently. I think part of the initial stated purpose of this bill certainly was the shaken baby syndrome type cases. Obviously, a 12-year-old is not going to be a victim of shaken baby syndrome because they're 12 years old, but the idea was that, you know, once a child hits puberty, that's really when they start to sort of develop their own, you know, set of muscles and can defend themselves in a way that a child who hasn't hit puberty yet can't. And so that was, I mean, I know that's not directly answering the 5-year question, but that was sort of where we, I mean, that was the direction we headed based on the testimony. And this had support from OCDLA as well as ODAA, although I will say it's sort of grudging support from ODAA. And I kind of encouraged that because I thought if we got it out of the House unopposed, we would have better luck.
Okay.
Later.
I have a motion to move the amendment.
Yeah, I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair, to accept the -1 amendments into House Bill 2322.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
And then also make a motion that House Bill 2322 would be moved to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Do you want to carry that, Representative?
Sure.
Okay, Representative Miss. Any further business before our committee today? Adjourned.